Right, no, no. So I want to recognize the east of the Bay Area for 14 years as an area. That's pretty impressive. I grew up in this area, and this is where I was born and raised. Spent the first 23 years of my life here in the east of the Bay Area. Recently moved away a couple of years ago. It's an honor and a privilege anytime to do a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. It's always something that I've been willing to do. I've always been excited about sharing my experience, strength, and hope. Where I came from, I really wasn't asked to talk much. And I didn't really need to talk much other than to say, who's got it or how do I get it? And to be asked to do this meeting is even more of an honor, more so than a privilege, to come back here in the area that I got clean in and be asked to speak at an anniversary meeting. That's an awesome feeling. I've been thinking about it for a couple weeks now, and I couldn't ask for a better place to speak at. I know there's a lot of people here, and I'm sure there's a lot of people here from the east of the Bay. So I think if you're from the east of the Bay or not, you should give yourself a round of applause right now for helping east of the Bay area make it to 14 years. Figure we clap for people when they get a year clean and 2 years clean and 14 years clean. Why not an area? Just trying to give myself a chance here to put my ego out to the side and allow God to come through me. Sometimes He gives me an opportunity to act on my will, and I'm just trying to allow Him this process. This is kind of surreal, man. I'm sitting up in front of a bunch of people with a podium in front of me. I don't know how I'm supposed to get my ego out of the side when I got this podium sitting in front of me. Like I'm important, and I'm standing above you all here. I'm not real comfortable with that because I'm right on the same level as you every day of the week. I'm an addict just like you. Some of you know my story, some of you don't. I grew up in a very, very misled family. I wouldn't even call them dysfunctional, because really I don't know too many families that were functional. I really still don't to this day. I know that me and my wife try to raise our children to the best of our ability, but we didn't have the best teachers, and I think that we fall short sometimes. But hello? That's okay. God's calling me. Let me step back a second. I'm also recognize something else here tonight. My beautiful wife Mary over there just had 7 years clean last night. That's a really awesome achievement. I love you. She's gonna get me for that one later. like I was saying, I grew up in an environment that wasn't conducive to to healthy relationships. My mother and father were both very involved in drugs. The whole lifestyle, the whole scene. I grew up in seeing a lot of violence and a lot of hatred and a lot of anger between the two people that I thought were supposed to love each other. The two people that I thought were supposed to provide for me and be there for me and show me how to grow up. They hated each other. On any given night I could wake up and watch them beating the hell out of each other with pots and pans. And this is the screwed up part about that, is that I grew used to it. I was okay with the fact that they hated each other that much. I thought that that's how people showed that they loved each other. because I saw it all the time. We lived a fairly normal life in my eyes. I didn't see any other difference. I remember being a child and watching the drug dealers come in and out of the house, and deals being made, and anytime that there was a big deal, there was always a shotgun on the table. I always knew when it was a big deal when there was a shotgun on the table. And I remember hiding underneath the bed, and I would read through my flashcards when I was like in kindergarten and first grade. And I would just hide under the bed with a flashlight, reading through my flashcards, teaching myself how to read while my parents were beating the hell out of each other right in front of me. That was the lifestyle that I lived. That was who I was becoming. I remember when I was like 7 years old, my father jumped out of a third-story window on right off of Main Street on Kent Island, for any of you all that are around here. Jumped out of a third-story window, hopped up on PCP after he pointed a gun to my mother's head, and I watched him get up and run away. I have a younger brother, and we woke up one morning after my parents had been in a daze, and the phone was ringing for hours and hours, but nobody would pick it up. Nobody woke up at my house at a reasonable time. I would wake up in the morning, and I would get the antenna ears going so I could try to watch some cartoons, and the phone was constantly ringing, and people were knocking on the door. Nobody was answering the door. My brother had crawled out when he was 2 years old, the second story window, and slid down. And he was walking around outside, and nobody knew. The neighbors had like found him and brought him back in the morning. For years, like, I used to like go out there, and that was my picture of what a God was, because you could see the fingerprints sliding down the white house where my brother had slid down at 2 years old. This isn't just right outside the window, jump down from here. This is two stories up. I always believed there was a God at that moment. You know what I mean? And the cinder blocks. He landed on cinder blocks. And he didn't have a scratch on him. He was walking. He was walking around. But that's the kind of lifestyle that I lived. And I don't tell you that because I want to make you feel like my life was horrible. Mind you, I really believed that that was a normal life. I was okay most of the time. But it wasn't so normal. And as I grew up, I was in school, and they used to give those DARE programs, say no to drugs type stuff. And I really believe, like, man, I'm never doing drugs. I see what it's doing to my family. I see what it's done in the people that surround my life. I'll never do drugs. I'd love to probably be sitting up here telling you that I never did drugs, but you probably wouldn't have asked me to come out here otherwise. And really, like, for a long time, I blamed my parents. I blamed my father for the way that he raised me. I blamed my mother for the things that she did to me growing up. I blamed my family for the way that I was, when really I was taught at a very young age what not to do firsthand. I can't blame them for what was done to me and who I became. I became who I chose to become. I had the decision on that day when the bullies down the street that used to beat me up every day at the bus stop said, "Here, you want to get high with us?" I had a choice that day to be cool and fit in or get beat up again and go on about my day. And I chose to get high. I got beat up anyway. All I wanted to do ever in my life was fit in. I heard Rick. I got a tape of Rick that I listen to every once in a while. He said something real profound, and I've heard a couple people say, I was never strong enough. I was never tall enough. I never jumped high enough. I never ran fast enough. I wasn't the right color. I wasn't ever anything but me. And that was never good enough. Not in my eyes. I always wanted to be you. I always wanted to have what you had. But I had what I had, and I felt like my hand was shit. you know, and I wasn't okay with it. You know, and I made that decision to use. And I tell you what, I got higher than I ever have got. You know, and I used to think back, like, when I was getting high, like, those old cliches of, like, you're chasing that first high. And when I was getting high, I was like, man, I'm always high. You know, now that I look back at it, I don't know that I ever got so high in my entire life than that first high. When I first introduced that drug into my body, it was the most powerful feeling I've ever felt in my life. I was tall enough, I was strong enough, I was the right color, I could jump high enough, I could run fast enough, I was the man. Meanwhile, I got beat up, you know. But I was still the man. You know, I didn't care what you thought about me anymore. You know, and I felt like I had some power. You know, moving about my life, I started to act just like my parents showed me not to. You know, at a very young age, I thought that in order to do drugs and to have this persona, you had to do other things. You had to be hard. You had to be tough. You had to fit in. I had to build this persona that I was the toughest person around. Grew up in Cloverfields. Okay? I know some of you don't even know what Cloverfields is, but just think of the name of the town, Cloverfields. Okay? I tried to turn that place into a straight-up ghetto. I really, really did. You know, like, we there was a bunch of guys. And I tell you what, I now live out in Owings Mills, and I go to meetings in the city and around the area, and I see some really hardcore people. And I tell you what scares me. I'm not so scared of driving down to Christian Street and hitting a meeting in the heart of the city. I'm not so afraid of that. I'm afraid of Cloverfields when I was a kid. We were kids that watched movies about thugs and gangsters and Scarface type shows and tried to reenact it. The guys in the city are street smart. They grow up living that way. I was trying to react a scene from a movie. That's scary. We were willing to do whatever it took to look hard, to look bad, to have this persona that you couldn't touch us in Cloverfields. Christian Street's got a good name to it. Cloverfield's not so good. I just continued to do whatever was necessary to get high and to be this person. And, you know, and like I said, there were some things that I felt like I had to do to be hard, to be in touch with this world, this drug world that I believed existed right in front of me. And it got me in a whole lot of trouble. You know, we had a hotel party, and it was at this place called The Sleep Inn, kind of not too far from here. It's been renamed and changed since then. But, you know, there was a lot of people at this party, and it was like in February of 96, like the first week in February. So, a good 9 years from now or something like that. And it was a blizzard. It was a real bad blizzard that night. And I don't mean just a snowstorm, like, you know, we get 2 inches of snow around these parts and people can't drive on the roads. I'm talking about it was snowing hard. And a bunch of us got into this hotel party and we were doing our thing. And like I said, man, I felt like I had to be this man, this drug dealer, this person that you were afraid of. And I'm sitting on the toilet in the back of the hotel like it's a throne, like it's the drug capital of the world. And I'm dealing out drugs from this bathroom. And you know, midway through the night, like, everybody was all, you know, hopped up on whatever they were on. And I guess some people got hungry, so they went and they broke into the vending machine. They just ripped the window clear off the front of it, took everything out, and brought it back and put it in the room. And then nobody ate it because nobody was really hungry. So it just sat there, and we kind of wound up throwing it in drawers and stuff like that, and it was all over the room. And the next morning, like, it, you know, the sun kind of came out, and the snow stopped, and people started leaving, and there's a handful of us still left there, about four of us still left there. My wife got lucky. She left about 15 minutes earlier, and knock, knock, knock on the door, and it was the police. And we opened up the door, and we were like, you know, yes, officer. Right? We've been getting high all night long. I'm still wasted. I was wasted for days after that. I laugh. I can't even tell this story without laughing to myself. So it's a funny story to me. If you don't laugh at this story when I'm done, it's really going to offend me. So at least pretend to laugh, okay? So the cop knocks on the door, and he said, look, we had a break into the vending machine last night, and we're just, you know, we're going around to see if anybody saw anything. No, officer, we didn't, you know. We just been hanging out here, you know, watching some TV, you know. We're all really young, you know. I think there was one of us that was 18, you know. And we're four guys. So I'm sure the cop was thinking either something weird's going on with you guys, or there's something else going on here with some drugs, maybe. Something's going on here. So we went ahead and let the officer in. And mind you, we saw him pull up. We saw the car, and we, like, started hiding all the candy. Like, getting it and putting it under the bed, under the mattress, flushing candy down the toilet, peanuts, Cracker Jacks, everything. Hiding it in the bathtub. I'm telling you, we were hiding some candy. There was a lot of freaking candy, and nobody ate any of it. Whole freaking vending machine. So, you know, he comes in and he's like, you know, have you guys seen anything? And we were like, no, we haven't seen anything. And he was like, well, that's funny. You guys are the only ones staying in this hotel. Damn. So he started like searching around, and he was like, yeah, I see some peanuts on the floor over there. That's kind of interesting. And so they started searching the room. They had enough reason, I guess, at that point to search the room, and they started finding candy. But the screwed up part is that we were so involved in hiding the illegal candy we had in the room that nobody hid the drugs. I still had everything in my pocket. You know, some guys had hid some stuff, like, in really stupid spots, like opened up a drawer and threw the stuff in there. Immediately we're cuffed, we're taken down to the police barracks in Centerville and arrested. And I thought it was a fun game at this point. Like, it didn't even register with me. I had just committed a crime and was arrested for the first time in my life. I thought it was fun. I was in the jail cell. Now, mind you, I was still really, really high. There's a cut. I'm dancing. I'm still hearing music in my head. And I'm dancing in the cell, and I'm singing. Like Eddie Murphy. You know, I'm singing Roxanne at the top of my lungs. And I thought it was funny. Life hit me in the face that day. You know, for any of you all that are local around here, there's a newspaper called the Bay Times. It's like a little area newspaper, and right in that newspaper, the next day when it came out, there was a nice little headline that said something like, "Candy Trail Leads to Drug Arrest." Because all the facts I told you were like that. It was snowing, and we stole some candy, and we were all high, and yeah, there was only a couple pairs of footprints leading from the vending machine back to our room through the snow. Everybody dropped candy the whole way there. And it was a cop's dream to show up there and go, yeah, this is going to be an easy one. Yeah. Okay. Let's play with these guys a little bit and see what we can get going. I'm really happy that you guys laughed a little bit about that. That was like my first introduction with the law. And it didn't stop there. That was just the beginning. You know, I was dealing drugs out of my mother's house. She didn't care because she would steal my shit and upset me about it a little bit. But My mom's way of grounding me. My mom's way of grounding me when we were getting high was that she used to steal my stuff. You know, you didn't go to school today. I'm taking your shit. Yeah, ass. 2 weeks later, I'd go back in her room, like searching for it, wonder what she's got left. It'd be a quarter. And I'd ask her about it. What'd you do, Mom? Flushed most of it down the toilet. No, you didn't. No, you didn't. I asked my mother before I came here if I could, you know, if there are certain stories that my mother's involved in that she's okay with me. You know, my mother's coming up on 2 years clean in the other fellowship. And I'm really proud of her. And so, you know, like I would deal drugs out of the front window of my mother's house in Cloverfields. And I would open the window. After some time I bought an open and close sign because people were coming to the window and I went to knocking on the window when I was sleeping. And like I was really starting to feel like I was this kingpin, like I was this big deal guy. I wasn't. I'm telling you straight up. Like, I'm not telling you this because it makes me feel like I'm a better person. I wasn't. I wasn't cool. I wasn't hip. I wasn't slick, unless you consider it, you know, terminal and fatal. And I guess what had happened was the cop said, you know what? He wants to look like this big deal guy. Let's make him feel like a big deal guy. And we pulled in the driveway one night. My brother was like 9, I think, at the time, or 10, and he was the only one home. And we pulled in the driveway. As soon as I got out of the car, there was a gun to my head, and I was stripped naked, basically, in my driveway. And it was the cops. They were searching the house. And we went into the house, and the house was a wreck. They had flipped stuff. They had broke stuff. They just were destroying the house. Meanwhile, my 9-year, 10-year-old brother had a gun to his head while he laid on the floor as well. And they found all my stuff, and they arrested me and gave me a bunch more charges, and that was another introduction to the law. And, like, during this whole time, like, I would think that, like, maybe a normal person that was getting involved in this type of stuff would say, wow, this is bad. This is stuff I shouldn't be doing. And I'll tell you what, they left a bottle of Aftershock was the only thing that they left in my entire room. And I drank that shit as soon as they were gone. You know, there was no thought about not using in my head. It was never, you know, it was never a thought in my head of could it be the drugs, like it talks about in the basic text. Could it be the drugs? It was never a thought of that. People were always on my back. It was because my family had a rap and everybody wanted to hurt me and get me next, you know. It was always somebody else's fault. And what basically happened was I got in a fight at school one day and I left and I came back to school and I don't really know, there's a long story there about me just never going to school anyway, so for me to go twice in one day was kind of weird. And when I showed up to school the second time, there was a drug counselor standing at the doorway. She looked at me. She was like, "Mr. Mayor, we've been waiting for you. I wanted to see you." And she called me down to the office. And she sat me down in the nurse's office and she started talking to me and she was like, "So I heard you've been arrested a couple times." And I was like, "Yeah." She looked at me. She said, "You're high right now, aren't you? How do you lie to somebody when they're staring you right in your eyes, 2 feet away, asking you if you're high? It's really difficult. I've done it a million times, but it was difficult that day. And it was difficult every time. But for some reason, something in me said, yeah." And I looked at her and I said, "I'm a bad person." And I really felt that way when I said it. And she looked right back at me and she said, "No, you're not bad. You're sick." And you know, for some of you all, that might not mean anything. For me, that touched my heart that day. And it still touches my heart today. I get cold chills on the back of my neck every time I say that. Because I really, really believe that I was bad. I really believe that the way I was raised was to be this person. I was just sick. The disease had caught up to me. And so what a real guidance counselor and drug counselor in a school, especially in a high school, is supposed to do is you're supposed to be taken down to the principal's office. You're supposed to be arrested. You're supposed to be expelled from school. You're high in school. You have drugs on you. You're in trouble. That's what's supposed to happen. This lady took me to the bathroom. She washed my hair with the soap that was in the... You know, Jen saw a picture of me when I used to have hair, and it wasn't that pretty. But she washed my hair with some soap right from the bathroom, because I didn't really clean myself that often. And she sprayed me with some perfume to clean up the smell on me. She told me she wanted to see me in 1 week. She wanted me to be clean for 1 week. You know, I don't know about you and how you got here and what happened to you, but nobody had ever given me a second chance in my entire life. And I mean that. On the baseball field, I sucked. I was playing baseball without contacts or glasses for years, and I struck out every time I got up. And when I went back to the bench, the coach was like, you know, I was the right fielder. I was the guy who you had to start because they paid for their freaking ticket or whatever, but you weren't any good. You know, and they let me know I wasn't any good. Living in the family that I lived in, I never got a second chance. My parents didn't ever, like, really treat me good. They didn't ever check my homework. They didn't ever do anything in that respect. I never was given a second chance there. I was never given a second chance in my entire life. I was given a second chance that day. And I knew it. And I went home that night, and for the first time since I had started getting high, I thought about it. I said, you know what? I'm not going to get high. I went to bed, and I got up, and I got high. And it broke my heart. It hurt me so bad inside that I had no control over the drugs anymore. And I told myself all through that day, I was just going to do it that once. And I got high later that day as soon as I came down, and I was like, man, I don't have any control, man. I was like telling my buddies, like, I ain't got no fucking willpower. I'm a puss, man. Can't do shit on my own. And I went back in front of her a week later, and she said, did you stay clean for the week? And I said, no. I tried. I couldn't do it. And she looked at me, and she was like, yeah, I didn't expect you to stay clean. She said, that has nothing to do on you. I just wanted to see if you had it in you. But she said, you've got a problem. And what I thought was true is true. And on April 24th of 1996, I got clean. I went to a rehab, and I have not used since then. And every day has been a blessing, man. Every day has been a new journey, a new... It's been great. I went to this rehab up in the mountains, and I tell you what, like, I didn't, like, get clean because I wanted to get clean. Seriously, I just got clean because, like, number one, I was about to go up for all these court... these charges in front of this judge that everybody knew was pretty bad about this kind of stuff. So I went ahead to rehab, and I remember, like, going up in front of this judge before I left, and I like looked at him, and he looked at me, and I said, you know, my public defender said, you know, he would like to go to a rehab first. Now, I wish I had a nickel for every time a judge heard that. Scott, that's like the first thing anybody ever says to a judge, you know. But he was like, all right, good. Let's send him away to this rehab, see if he can get some help. And then he, like, did one of these numbers with his glasses, and he looked across the table, and he was like, Mr. Mayor, when you're done in this rehab, I'm going to charge you for all this anyway. Damn! So now I got to go to rehab and come back and still get locked up. You know, the whole reason I was doing this was so I didn't get locked up. But I went to this rehab, and I sat in, and I became that perfect patient. Since day one, like, well, I don't really want to say day one, because I was pretty sick for a couple days. But I became this perfect patient. I would sit in the groups, and I would tell you all about how you can better your recovery, you know, and what you can do to resolve your issues. Never telling you about me. Never giving you any information about me. And it came back to bite me, man. You know, I had about 90 days clean. Something inside of me was starting to say, as soon as you get out of here, you're going to get high. As soon as you go back there, you're going to get high. You have done nothing to change. And we were going to a 12 o'clock meeting that day. And I sat at this little white table in the rehab. And I thought about it, and I decided that I was going to share in this meeting. I'd never raised my hand. I'd never shared. I don't know what the first time was like for you when you first shared in a meeting. Man, it was like getting high for me. But I sat at this table and I processed for 2 hours what I was going to say, and it was very short and it was very simple. And she walked past me, and this is my first introduction with the second step. You know, I wasn't really working like steps with a sponsor at that time, but it was my first introduction with the second step, looking back in retrospect. And I was crazy up in my head. I was insane. And she walked by, and she was humming this song. And this song was a song that I hadn't heard for, like, at that point in time, 10 years. You know, when my mom was like cleaning for periodic days, she would hum me this lullaby. It's this Irish lullaby. And I had never heard it before other than from my mother. She was the only one that sang it. And for some reason, like, I believed it was like passed down through like my family or something real spiritual like that and shit. But I had never heard it before, so I kind of like really did believe this. She was humming this Irish lullaby when she walked past me. And like, everything in my body at that moment just kind of chilled as she walked by. And I realized at that moment, like, just do what you got to do. You know, it might not mean anything to you, and it might not have any impact on your story, but for me, it was like the moment that I realized that I could do this, you know, that there was something else there. And I went to that meeting, and I was ready to share at the end of the meeting, and there was like a minute left, and I was ready to raise my hand, and the guy next to me, Mike, he raised his hand and he shared, and I was so pissed off because there was going to be no time for me. And see, this is where the third step finally hit me. The first, second, and third step hit me all in one day, and the third step hit me. And Mike raised his hand and he shared. He said, my name is Mike and I'm an addict. I'm about to get out of this rehab. I'm afraid of getting high. Please help me. He was done. Mike shared exactly what I was going to share. And I'm not telling you this because it's some spiritual story. I'm dead serious. Mike shared word for word what I was going to share, except for his name. And the third step hit me. And see, I didn't realize this at this time. I was still kind of pissed at Mike after the meeting, but I kind of followed him around. And, you know, me too. I feel like I'm going to get high. But looking back, like, the second step, like, hit me. And it was like, you know, God was there and He was restoring me to sanity. He was just saying, do it. And then the third step hit me, and it was like, God said, when you're willing to do the work that I've put in front of you, I'm going to make it easier for you. I'm going to show you people who have done this and who are willing to do it the same way that you are, so that you don't always have to feel like the monkey's on just your back. You know, and I went away to a longer-term rehab, and I stayed in that facility for another, like, 9 months. So by the time I got out, I almost had a year clean and thought I was king shit when I came to the east of the Bay Area. And a lot of people in this place are still here from when I got clean. And I was a punk kid with different hair every week and baggy pants down to my knees. I still had that persona. I still had that look. And you still weren't going to touch me. I was still harder and stronger than anybody in here. And I remember coming to a meeting one night and bitching about how it was all my father's fault. And somebody said, you should be grateful to have a father because my father's not alive anymore. And I picked up the chair that I was sitting in and I threw it across the room because you weren't going to talk to me like that. You weren't going to treat me like that. I went to another meeting a couple weeks later and I started bitching in that meeting. And this lady named Wendy, she said, you know what? Get up out of that fucking chair and leave. Go get high because you're fucking using up a seat for somebody that wants to get clean. And I hated Wendy for about 15 minutes. Till I got in that car and I started driving home. And I realized that I needed to let down some walls. And I needed to start letting people into my life. And I'll tell you what, you know, I started letting people into my life and I was very uncomfortable to start. You know, I was very uncomfortable with where I was going in my life. And you all embraced me. And told me that you'd love me till I could figure out what the hell love was. You know, I started working this program and I started working the steps. You know, writing them down, everything about it. Got involved in service. I mean, I think I was 18? And I was the chair of the East of the Bay Area. It was a scary thought. I don't know about y'all. But that was a scary friggin' thought, you know. And I don't say any of this to like boost. This is confidence. You know, this is the stuff that has happened in my life by working this program, you know. A couple years ago, I was in the midst of a sixth step. I always say that. I was not working on a sixth step. In the midst of a sixth step. That's like fucking candy coating it and shit. I was not working on a sixth step. All my defects were revealed to me. And I said, hell no, I'm not working on that shit. I'm just fine with what I got. Let me just keep going at this pace. And this girl told me I was cute. And she wasn't my wife. And I had a relationship with this woman. You know, I built a relationship with her. I didn't step out in a physical way, but I had a relationship with this person. I was talking to her more than I was talking to my wife. And everybody in the East of the Bay Area knew about it. And they were all ready to tell my wife. And I went home and I told my wife. It's one of the hardest things I've ever done in my entire life. And my wife looked at me that night and she said, you better go pick up that phone and you better call people. She hated me at that moment, in that time. I hated me. But she did not like me. And I guarantee you, but she looked at me and she wanted to make sure that no matter what, I wasn't going to get high. And I went and I started making phone calls and I started asking for help. And I tell you what, that was about 4 years ago. And I have worked this program like every day is the last since then. And I will continue to do that because I never want to feel that kind of pain while I'm clean again. I felt that growing up. I felt that pain when I was using. And I do not want to feel it in here. And what you've taught me is all I got to do is take some simple suggestions. Work these steps, go to meetings, get involved in service, and I don't have to feel that way. I don't have to hate myself. I don't have to degrade myself, and I don't have to hurt people in the process, even when I say I'm hurting nobody but myself. It's in this program, man, and if you're not doing it, if you're not working the 12 steps, if you're not getting involved in service, give yourself a break, because you're fooling yourself. Everybody else around you knows. Everybody looks at you and goes, if only that person would just do this. they too can feel what I feel. You know, but it's not a decision I can make for you. It's not something that I can just make happen in your life. You got to make that decision. You got to reach out, just like I did, just like I have to do every day. Even on the days when I wake up and I don't want to. Even in Baltimore City, where I have to go and watch people killing themselves with this shit called dope every day. You know? I've watched more people relapse in the year and a half that I've lived over there in Baltimore than I did the entire first 7 years that I stayed clean here. And that's not to say the Bay doesn't got it bad. I'm just telling you, like, it's painful. I help people and I'm watching them go out and commit suicide the next day. You know, this program is here for all. The lady before shared, and she shared something real powerful. You know, she said there are no dues and fees. You know, you don't have to pay anything to do it here. And the real kick is you already paid it. You already paid with interest. What we did out there is why we're here. And my reminder every day is that my name is Eric and I'm an addict. When I say that, when I say I'm an addict, I'm remembering my entire childhood, everything I did while I was using, and everything cruddy I've done since I've been clean. Because that's who I am. I'm an addict. But this program has taught me I don't have to live that way. I can be a recovering addict today. I just have to follow some simple guidelines. I hope to continue doing that. I hope East of the Bay Area has another 14 years. Just for today, let's make this a good one. Thanks for letting me share.